From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the latest attempt by the U.S. Senate to replace Obamacare, but with what? And how would it be felt in Texas? And the U.S. northern and southern borders have more in common than you'd think. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The clock is ticking for Republican leaders in Washington, D.C. to pass their latest Obamacare repeal bill. There is a September 30th deadline to have a new law in place before the budget reconciliation, and the U.S. Senate is set for a possible vote next week on a bill sponsored by Republican Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana. If passed and signed into law by President Trump, the Graham-Cassidy bill would create winners and losers among the 50 states. Each state would implement their own health care plans with block grants of federal funding. It would also end federal funding for Obamacare's Medicaid expansion and terminate the subsidies that help people afford coverage, as well as void the law's individual insurance mandate. Instead, states would be given pots of money, and they would decide how to spend it. The bill takes federal dollars from high-spending Medicaid expansion states like California and brings it to states that rejected the Medicaid expansion like Texas. And states like Texas could decide to take away protections for insurance consumers like the one for pre-existing condition. How would this impact Texas insurance consumers? Texas continues to lead the nation in the number of uninsured, but more people under Obamacare have gotten health insurance in Texas. Stacy Pogue is a senior policy analyst at the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She says Graham-Cassidy could have both short-term and long-term impacts on health care in Texas, and both are negative and harmful to Texans.
One, in the short term, there is a new block grant that's essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul. So it would take funding away from coverage for low-income workers in other states and bring it to Texas, and we'd get a short-term funding bump for 7 years. That all goes away in 2027 when there is just enormous cuts to our Medicaid program that remain and would hurt every state, not just Texas. But there's other things that happen in that short-term period other than the block grant that are worth noting because they could be really harmful. We lose all guarantee of subsidies and affordability for marketplace coverage. We lose marketplace coverage, right? The state would have to set something new up on a very short timeline. And the state could also waive the protections we have that ensure people aren't charged more if they're sick and that we have adequate benefits in our policies. So lots of short-term changes and lots of instability in the insurance markets because of that. That could mean premiums go up and people lose coverage starting as early as next year.
Senator Graham says that this is giving more authority to states to decide about health care coverage and that states are more accountable to the people than the federal government is. You can call up your state representative and you can complain or other people in your state government and you would have a better response than if you tried to call up someone in the federal government.
I guess I don't know how to evaluate or approach the level of accountability. I can say that he is certainly right that one of the big provisions in his bill is totally turning on its head the federal-state balance or partnership on funding for health care and moving all of the responsibility or much of the responsibility to the state level. And that places an enormous responsibility on the shoulders of states, especially ones like Texas that really haven't shown any interest in pursuing, you know, new or innovative ideas in how to make sure low-income Texans get covered.
Well, I guess then if Senator Graham, if he says it's true, then we could look at the track record of the state of Texas and how it provides social services and make judgments on whether or not we want to have more of that, especially when it comes to our health care.
Yeah, but there's one thing that idea doesn't capture, and it's that the block grant is temporary. It goes away entirely after 2026. And so to the degree that Texas could act quickly and in good faith to ensure affordable coverage to its low-income citizens in the next few years, the federal government rips that funding away entirely in 2027. And so it would be really hard for our state and others to put coverage programs into place knowing that the funding won't be there going forward. And if Congress does intend to reappropriate that money, and I'm sure there would be, you know, debates to do that and battles to do that, it would be really hard for them to find the kinds of offsets and revenues they would need to replace $200 billion a year in federal funding that Graham Cassidy lets expire unnecessarily. So there's a huge financial, fiscal cliff, healthcare cliff that is created in this bill that does not exist today.
Right. The fiscal cliff is there. Also, though, this allows the state to set a lot of these policies through waivers, for example, the pre-existing condition. Now, that's going to really be up to states, whether or not the pre-existing condition exclusion is going to be part of policy or not.
Right.
And so what would you think Texas would do if it has a chance to apply for that waiver?
I can tell you what we did in the past. So before the Affordable Care Act, it was also a state option whether states wanted to let insurance companies charge people more if they were sick. And Texas, like almost every other state, did. It doesn't mean we'd make that decision again in the future, right? But we have a track record in Texas of having an opportunity to have state laws that protect consumers and passing on them, right? There was nothing that stopped us from protecting people with pre-existing conditions before the Affordable Care Act.
Texas also has a track record of using block grants from the federal government for not necessarily what that money was intended.
Right. And so block grants come with real risks for states. They're not flexible in any way to adjust for things like public health emergencies or hurricanes or natural disasters. And as you point out, we have a long track record, a 20-year track record with a TANF block grant. That's the cash assistance program for families, very low-income families with children. And over time, the amount of funding that we spend in Texas on actual cash assistance has declined. And today, only 6% of the federal block grant funds for TANF actually go directly to low-income families in the form of cash assistance. And all of the rest of the funding, more than 90% of the funding, is diverted in our state budget to other programs. And they're good programs, right? But that's what we could see happen with a health care block grant, is that it's used by budget writers in Texas to fund things we fund with state dollars today and to plug every state hole, budget hole, and prop up state programs instead of replacing or building coverage for low-income Texans.
So they can use the federal dollars for programs that they're not intended for. Basically, they're using that money to pay for tax cuts.
I guess I'd have to think through this, but it could be possible in a way to pay for tax cuts, but it'd be in an indirect way, which is the block grant money under Graham Cassidy has to be spent for healthcare purposes, but there's not a lot of direction around that. It certainly does not have to be spent to replace, say, the marketplace subsidies that ensure low-income people could afford private coverage. It doesn't have to be invested in coverage programs or premium subsidies, right? So it could be used by states that want to supplant state funding on healthcare-related things. So to the degree that we use state dollars on healthcare for medical schools or higher education systems for healthcare providers or healthcare in prisons or mental health and family planning. So there's plenty of places in our state budget where we use state dollars for healthcare. We could take the federal grant and supplant those. And that's what the TANF track record shows, right? That's what we've done, is use federal block grants to replace state spending. That would free up the state spending for other purposes that could include tax cuts.
So what does this mean? If the Graham Cassidy bill gets passed, they take out Obamacare, and what will this mean for the average person in Texas and their health insurance?
Yeah, so the immediate effect in the next year would be there's 1.8 million people who get coverage in what we call the individual market. They don't get it through their job or Medicare or Medicaid. They buy it on their own directly. The premiums in that market would be expected under this bill to go up rapidly up next year, the year after the bill passes, and fewer insurers would participate in that market because of the instability and kind of chaos and uncertainty that would be caused by this. Then in 2020, people who get subsidies through the health insurance marketplace which the last time I looked was 800 or 900,000 Texans, those subsidies would end entirely, and the state would, between now and 2020, have to put some new coverage programs or, you know, efforts into place using the block grant funding to pursue the state's priorities, right? And then in 2027, what we'd see in Texas, because that block grant goes away entirely, would be 2.8 million Texans would lose coverage. Nationally, 32 million Americans would lose coverage. So there's a huge healthcare cliff that's put into place in Graham Cassidy, where millions of people would lose coverage after the short horizon at the beginning.
We don't know everything that this bill is going to do. The Congressional Budget Office is not going to be able to release its analysis of the Graham Cassidy until the week of September 25th, and we're going to have the vote, looks like, next week.
Yeah, so Congress will have to take these votes without all the information they've had in the past on bills to replace Obamacare that have been rejected, right? For all of the ones before, they at least had a complete score or analysis from the Congressional Budget Office to show what would happen not only to the deficit in federal spending, but to premiums that we pay for health insurance and how many people are covered with health insurance. There's enough independent analysis that's out at this point where we, based on prior CBO scores for prior versions of Obamacare repeal, that we can say, and all of them show this, they all show huge federal funding losses across states over the long term and millions of people losing insurance. So Congress certainly won't have all of the information it is accustomed to, but there are lots of independent analysis showing that there is significant harm that will be done by this bill.
Medicaid, how is that going to be impacted?
So what this bill does is use what's called a per capita cap. That is a way to permanently cap and cut the Medicaid program. So in Texas, we didn't expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. We have our traditional program. It covers... it's mostly children. It covers mostly children in Texas, but it also provides care for half of all births in Texas and more than two-thirds of all the people in nursing homes. It covers many individuals with disabilities who need help with general activities of daily living. And what the bill does is create cuts to the Medicaid program that are large and grow over time. And so that's how we would see over time that Texas would lose a significant amount of federal funding over the next two decades, even including the bump we see in federal funding right up front. Over the next two decades, we would lose $120 billion in federal funds because those Medicaid cuts are so big and grow so fast over time.
You know, we have these Senators Cassidy and Graham up there on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC saying that none of these bad things are going to happen. This is a good deal for America, that they're not going to lose the pre-existing condition. What's your reaction when you hear these senators saying things that counter what you just told me?
For everybody trying to come up to speed on this bill that is moving quickly and is poorly understood, you know, across the spectrum, it's challenging, right? This is going to be a bill that Congress is going to vote on that's not going to be fully understood at all before they vote on it, right? But there's some pretty clear ways that we can see that there's not rock-solid protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Written into the bill very clearly is that states have the ability to waive the current ACA protections around essential benefits and not charging people with pre-existing conditions more. What we can't know, none of us, is how states will act on that, and will they, you know, repeal all of the protections or weaken them somewhat or do nothing to them at all, right? But it is clearly allowed under the letter of that law that states can undo a lot of the protections in the Affordable Care Act. So it just wouldn't be accurate to say that there's a guarantee for people with pre-existing conditions. This bill actually undoes that guarantee. Today we have a federal guarantee, and that would be rewritten under Graham Cassidy.
Stacey Pogue is a senior policy analyst for the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She says the Graham Cassidy Obamacare repeal and replace bill would be harmful to Texans. Drew White at the Texas Public Policy Foundation is also not a fan of this legislation, although for very different reasons. He says it doesn't go far enough to eliminate the regulations of the Affordable Care Act.
It does a few things differently than previous GOP efforts. It actually keeps most of the Obamacare taxes in place and uses that particular revenue for a new $1.2 trillion spending program wherein Medicaid money and the Obamacare premium subsidies are kind of lumped into a single pool and then distributed to states. TPPF has been, I would say, objectively analyzing this based off a free market, liberty-oriented perspective. We believe that there are some good things in the bill. We believe that some of the flexibility that the bill attempts to give to states, as well as the repeal of the individual and employer mandate, is good policy. However, if you're wanting to drive down premiums, if you're wanting to provide people with more affordable and better quality care, and you're wanting to give people options, you have to repeal the Obamacare insurance regulations, and this bill simply does not do that.
So, Drew White from the Texas Public Policy Foundation, are you in the Senator Rand Paul camp from Kentucky? He says no, because it still has a lot of the stuff from Obamacare in it.
So I think Senator Paul's got some very valid critiques of the bill. That being said, we do think there are ways that the Senate can actually improve the bill and get it closer to a place where, you know, it may be more palatable to folks. One of the things that we proposed is, instead of having these complicated waivers that may or may not work for states to sort of waive themselves out of some of the regulations in Obamacare, what they should do is just repeal the regulations at the federal level outright and then provide a potential opt-in trigger for other states if they want to readopt the Obamacare regulations. So, for instance, you repeal it at the federal level, and then if California wants to readopt that, or if New York wants to readopt the Obamacare insurance regulations, they would have an avenue to do that. But a state like Texas could regulate its own insurance market in a way that Texas feels is appropriate. We think that's the appropriate way to view sort of good policy in terms of providing a free market while also staying true to the real tenets of real federalism.
Texas, I mean, it's asked for waivers before. It's not shy about waivers, probably a safe bet, don't you think, that Texas would take advantage of all the waivers it could possibly use? So what's wrong with that?
Well, it remains to be seen. The way these current waivers are structured in the bill, they first off don't allow for the state to completely opt out of all the Obamacare insurance regulations. And it's important for your audience to remember, a lot of these insurance mandates and regulations are the number one reason that people's premiums and deductibles have doubled or tripled over the past 4 years since Obamacare was first implemented. And the reason why is that it forces certain policies on insurers, and then the costs are then transferred down to the consumer or the patient, in this instance, the person who has the insurance. We believe that in order for a state like Texas to have a bevy of options and for people to receive the kind of coverage that is tailored to their specific healthcare needs, we have to be as a state and as a people fully free from the federal mandates. The way these waivers are structured, there's language in there which says, you know, hey, Texas, you can waive out of this particular regulation so long as you agree to keep this regulation. And so we've got concerns that it actually doesn't do what its proponents are saying it's going to do. We're hopeful that they'll be able to make some amendments and change the language to provide actual and real flexibility for Texas. But as of this moment, that remains to be seen.
Well, we do know that there are rising costs in healthcare. They continue to outstrip inflation, and rising costs for drugs and pharmaceuticals, they continue to rise incredibly. And so, but what these regulations are trying to do is trying to make sure that there's more people are able to get insurance. So if these waivers are all put through, will that make it harder for individuals to get health insurance?
So I think the way that we view this and the way to look at it is, you know, candidly speaking, from our perspective, you know, you can give everybody an insurance card and you can mandate that everyone has to have insurance. But we think that the American people and Texans in general care more about the cost of their insurance and the quality of it. You know, a lot of ways, you know, if you have an insurance card but you don't have a good doctor and your coverage is not good, what's the point anyway? We firmly believe, and if you look at it from a policy perspective, and we believe that lawmakers need to be honest about this in both parties, you can have guaranteed mandated coverage for, let's say, a pre-existing condition, but you can't also have low costs. You have to choose. And we believe the best way to ensure that people with pre-existing conditions have options that are affordable and that people who are either in the individual market or in other markets have options to have a health care plan tailored to their specific health care needs, you have to have a free market. And the only way to have a free market and have options is to peel back the regulations and peel back the federal intervention that Obamacare really doubled down on. Now, that's not to say that before Obamacare was passed, everything was perfect. I think everybody in your audience would agree that we've had a pretty messed up healthcare system for a long time. And the reason for that is you've had a lot of federal laws that have sort of centralized supply and demand of healthcare in Washington, D.C. We believe this is an opportunity to finally bring the debate back home, closer to people, to their state lawmakers, to empower patients and doctors, instead of trying to continue to create a one-size-fits-all approach from Washington, D.C.
Senator Graham on the floor, when he was explaining the bill, one of his points was, this is the bill that we have to pass in order to avoid socialism. And I think he was referring to Senator Bernie Sanders' plan for a single-payer Medicaid total expansion plan. Do you see it that way?
First off, Senator Sanders' plan is just totally unworkable. Let me just start with that. Not only unworkable, it's terrible policy, will result in $32 trillion in spending that we're already $20 trillion in debt. I mean, it's not going to happen. It shouldn't happen. And it will ruin people's health care. It will destroy the American healthcare system. That being said, our current system, I would argue, is a little bit of a venture socialism system in and of itself, with the insurers, big insurers, and big government kind of working together to hide costs from the consumers. And the only way you break through that, with all due respect to Senator Graham, is you need to decentralize power out of Washington. You need to give people more control over their care.
Drew White is the senior federal policy analyst at the Center for 10th Amendment Action at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He supports the passage of the Graham-Cassidy repeal of the Affordable Care Act, although he says it doesn't go far enough. Earlier, we heard from Stacey Pogue. She's a senior policy analyst at the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She says the Graham-Cassidy Obamacare repeal and replace bill would be harmful to Texans. Border security is a topic that fills the news these days, but when problems at the border are mentioned, rarely does anyone ask which border. There are two lines of demarcation that cleave the United States from its neighbors to the south and the north. Both are explored in All the Agents and Saints, the latest book by Stephanie Elizondo Greist. Yvette Benavides has this review.
Few of us have traveled the long 1,100-mile serpentine stretch of the U.S.-Mexico border. Even fewer understand the bookend of another border to the north. Stephanie Elizondo Greist is someone who does. While in a visiting professorship at St. Lawrence University in far upstate New York, just miles south of Canada, and armed with a long simmering idea presented to her by nonfiction guru John McPhee in 2006, she began her work. The book is a comparative study of two rivers, the Rio Grande and the St. Lawrence River, two arbitrary borders dividing nations and two peoples, the Akwesasne Mohawks, whose territory was split between Canada and the United States by a series of treaties signed between 1783 and 1850, and the Tejanos of South Texas, who were severed from their native Mexico by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848. The research yielded All the Agents and Saints. Here, Elizondo Greist, the world traveler, brings us another thoughtful account of yet another pilgrimage to give us all a vicarious look into places we wouldn't otherwise know about. As with Around the Block, about her travels to communist bloc countries, and her 100 Places Every Woman Should Go, the nomadic author reminds us that the world is a big, beautiful place, with corners and edges begrudgingly open to some, inhospitable or downright inhumane to others. Now, what could Mohawks and Tejanos possibly have in common, 2,000 miles apart and different in very basic ways? Yet Elizondo Greist, who's originally from Corpus Christi, Texas, could not help her feelings of deja vu while she researched that northern space. She found that, just like the denizens of the U.S.-Mexico border, those native peoples on the Canadian border preceded borderlines by centuries. Just like many Tejanos do not speak Spanish any longer, their language long canceled out by punitive measures in schools and all public domains, likewise do the Mohawks retain only echoes of their indigenous language. Mohawks can no longer subsist as they once did, fishing, trapping, and hunting. The vaquero traditions of Texas are all but vanquished, now a livelihood or pastime of mostly the rich white cattle ranchers. Both lands, north and south, are sickened from toxins released by the petrochemical companies that swarm on the fringes of both countries. Both groups die in alarming numbers of diabetes and other maladies brought about by poverty and obesity that results from that poverty, the food deserts and desperate measures to survive, even if only on cheap artificial food. Both groups also grieve immeasurable losses of land, of culture, of dignity, replaced now by a sad history of deeds, treaties, checkpoints, and the inherent persistent problems of profiling and a host of other persecutions. Both groups share the sorrowful history and current state of being relegated to a third-class status, never welcome at the table of their respective country. A feeling of separateness runs through much of Elizondo Greist's constant search of belonging after decades of traveling the world, as in a previous book, Mexican Enough, where she describes this feeling of being not from here and not from there, not being either Mexican or American enough, living in between two cultures and two worlds, standing in the middle, but ever on the fringes. Elizondo Greist also writes about Nepantla, an Aztec term for living in a state of in-betweenness. That is the word that denoted the feeling of struggling to reconcile indigenous life with what was enforced by Spanish colonizers in the 16th century. It's a term some might also recognize from the work of Gloria Anzaldúa, who used Nepantla as a metaphor for a birthing stage, where you feel like you're reconfiguring your identity and don't know where you are. The author offers that this idea is probably what led her back to a feeling of being home at last, after a lifetime of feeling split in two. Sherman Alexie, the renowned author, wrote in the essay Superman and Me about teaching himself to read on a reservation in Spokane. On the page he read, he noticed what was a paragraph without really knowing the word paragraph. He noticed that it worked like a fence, separating one group of sentences from another. The young Alexie said his family was a paragraph. His reservation was a paragraph. This country. But what delighted him most about that innocent discovery was that even if we are in separate paragraphs, we are all part of the same story. We all have common experiences to link us. All together, the paragraphs form one composite whole. That's what Elizondo Greist shows us again. All the Agents and Saints shows the ways in which two groups 2,000 miles away, people who had enjoyed vastly different ways of life, suffer and survive and even thrive in similar ways as a consequence of a fence, a wall, a partitioning of the planet that is unnatural and anathema to humanity. We will listen again on the news to the politicians dictating policies about borders and walls. With all the Agents and Saints, Elizondo Greist brings us the testimonies of those who actually witnessed life there and know the real story.
Yvette Benavides is a writer and a professor of English at Our Lady of the Lake University. She reviewed All the Agents and Saints, the latest book by Stephanie Elizondo Greist. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.